Welcome to Catholic Answers Live, the program where you participate with your questions about apologetics and evangelization, including the most important theological, spiritual, moral, and social issues facing the world today. Call now with your question for today's guest, toll-free 1-888-31-TRUTH. That's 888-318-7884. Now, from San Diego, Catholic Answers Live.
Hello and welcome again to Catholic Answers Live Open Forum today, because it's a Thursday and that's what we do on Thursdays. Open Forum means please call with any question you have on the life, the faith, the history of the Catholic Church. If you have a question about ethics or morals, those are welcome. A question about philosophy, about world religions even, all those things are welcome, because Open Forum means your questions are welcome. And you don't have to be Catholic to call. Anybody can call. 888-318-7884. Is our number, 888-318-7884. Our guest this hour, Jimmy Akin, senior apologist here at Catholic Answers and the author of A Daily Defense, 365 Days Plus One to Becoming a Better Apologist. Hi, Jimmy.
Howdy, Si. How you doing?
I am pretty well, thank you. How are you?
Are you sure about that? Have you checked recently on your present status?
My temperature seems fine, and I don't have any boils on my skin. Mm-hmm. Yes, I'm feeling.
Those are your ambitions in life.
Well, did you want me to be well in a?
Yeah.
In some, yeah, I think
well,
at a
I'd
minimum
love for you to be well in many senses.
Yeah, all right, fair enough. I think I am generally well. My back hurts a little, but I didn't want to bring that up. But,
okay. Well, on balance, I mean,
on balance.
At least you don't have boils on your skin and your temperature's okay.
Yeah. Right. Those are at least my baseline that I want to start with. No boils on the skin, no fever. Happy Advent to you.
Likewise.
By the way. I keep being reminded whenever I talk to Father Hugh that it's a very short Advent this year.
It is.
And why does that happen? Why do we get a short Advent? Somebody was saying, well, why don't you just put the Feast of Christ the King a week earlier, and then you could have the full Advent. Why won't that work?
Because the timing of the Feast of Christ the King is tied to the timing of Easter.
Oh, okay.
And so because Easter is movable, that makes Christ the King movable, and that makes the beginning of Advent movable.
Oh, I see. So, yeah, unless you want to do has there been talk or is there talk now about Easter kind of settling down?
Yes.
And finding like, let's just do Easter on that Sunday.
Yeah, there has been talk about that. In fact, that's been proposed as one of the ways for potentially getting Christians on the same page with regard to the celebration of Easter, which historically has been a very high priority. There has been a great desire all throughout history for Christians to be able to celebrate Easter on the same day. And one of the proposals for how to help that happen would be rather than arguing about, okay, are we going to use the Gregorian calendar or the Julian calendar and which moon are we going to use and stuff like that, let's just use a different system and say pick a Sunday, maybe third Sunday of April or something like that, and that'll be Easter for everybody. And so there has been discussion of that, but nothing concrete has resulted from that yet.
So who are the people who are celebrating it, I mean, differently? Like, for example, in the Catholic Church, all of the rites would celebrate the same
Sunday. On the same day, yeah.
So then it would be Orthodox Catholics
and different Orthodox Christians. So it depends on where you are. Like Russian Orthodox, for example, still use the Julian calendar, which is like 2 weeks out of sync.
Right.
Well, more than 2 weeks now, I guess. Out of sync with the Gregorian calendar. And then there may be other groups that use additional systems that I'm not familiar with. I haven't looked into that.
888-318-7884, our number, 888-31-TRUTH. If you have a question about the life, the faith, the history of the Catholic Church, what we believe, what we do, what we don't do, all those questions are welcome. Maybe there's someone in your life you'd like to have an answer to help them, and you don't have that answer, give a call. And as I said, you don't have to be Catholic to call. How about we start with Jim in Sacramento listening on Relevant Radio. Jim, you are on with Jimmy Akin. Hi, Jim.
Hi, Jimmy. Hi. Listen, we're doing a study at our parish. It's a RCIA meeting. It's on the Christian moral living.
Mm-hmm.
And so what I'm wondering is I see references to something that's written on the human heart.
Mm-hmm.
but I never really can find what it is that's written on the human heart. And is it only written on people that are the heart that's baptized, or is it everyone's heart?
Okay. The scriptural root for this, or one of the key scriptural passages that discusses this, is in Romans chapter 1. And St. Paul in that chapter is talking about Jews and Gentiles, and Jews have God's law in an explicit form, in the form of the law of Moses, the first five books of the Bible, Genesis through Deuteronomy, which in Hebrew are those books are known as the Torah, which means the instruction or the law, and they contain God's rules for the Jewish people. Now, Gentiles, not having a Jewish background, were typically not familiar with the law of Moses. But St. Paul says even though they don't have God's law in that form, they do have God's moral law written on their heart in a sense. And so they have, just by instinct, by their consciences, they have a moral sense that at least approximates what we find in the Torah. And consequently, they, in a kind of poetic way, have the law of God written on their hearts. And so that's what he's talking about. He's talking about the basic rules of morality as given to us by God. And in some cases, they're given to us in a written literary form, like in the law of Moses. In other cases, and frankly in everybody's case, they're given to us in an internal way by the light of our conscience that St. Paul poetically depicts as being written on our hearts. Obviously, you know, they're not literally transcribed on our hearts in ink or anything like that. So this is a metaphor. But that's what the metaphor is about. It's about the universal human awareness of basic moral principles.
Okay, Jim?
Don't kill someone, or
like,
the Ten Commandments. You mean, basically?
Exactly, yeah. Don't kill, don't steal, don't lie, all of those things.
So the Jewish people would have it kind of spelled out to them in the Ten Commandments, but a Gentile audience or non-baptized people would just have it be an internal feeling.
That's correct. You know. And as well as training, you know, in other forms, but everybody has it in an internal way.
And that they would more or less parrot the Ten Commandments?
Well, yeah. Now, it's not going to be every one of the Ten Commandments, because people all over the world don't have a Sabbath. But they aren't all monotheists and so forth. But certainly the second table of the Ten Commandments that deal with love of neighbor are all ones that people everywhere in the world have as human universals, the rules that appear just in every culture. Don't steal, don't kill, don't commit adultery, don't lie, all those things. Those are human universals.
Jim, thank you very, very much for that call. You've taken us right up to the break. We'll take a quick break, and we'll be right back with more Open Forum with Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live right after this.
Catholic Answers Live.
Pope Francis said, "The key that opens the door to the faith is prayer." Join St. Paul Street Evangelization by running a prayer station in the public square. You don't need to be a professional apologist or theologian. Just listen to the needs of the people you encounter. Offer encouragement, take prayer requests, and pray with people. Find out more and get involved today at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
Christmas is coming, and with Advent already upon us, we want to make sure you know about our annual Christmas sale with hundreds of great faith-building resources all on sale at 20% off when you enter promo code WINTER at checkout. With great new resources on Scripture, church history, the saints, Bible prophecy, and so much more, there's simply no better time to stock up on resources to build up your faith and the faith of those around you. Phone 888-291-8000 or go to the shop at Catholic.com right now to take advantage of what is truly the best Catholic sale on the internet, going on now through the end of the year. And remember, enter promo code WINTER at the checkout to save 20% on hundreds of great resources throughout the store.
The Catholic Answers Minute. I'm Father Vincent Serpa. In Matthew 11:11, Jesus said to the crowds, "Amen, I say to you, among those born of women, there has been none greater than John the Baptist. Yet the least in the kingdom of heaven is greater than he." John was the last of the Old Testament prophets. And speaking of Jesus, he had said, "I must decrease that he may increase." Like St. Joseph, he was glad to work in the background in preparation for the Redeemer. But for the Lord, there is only foreground. No loving deed ever passes unnoticed by him. He tells us to pray in secret, not that he doesn't expect us to pray together also, but prayer in secret is intimate and not for the eyes of anyone but him. Each one of us needs to pray daily in this way. Our private self is who we really are. Find a quiet spot in your day. You have words that need to be said to him, and he has words for you as well. I'm Father Vincent Serpa for Catholic Answers, Catholic.com.
Call now with your question, 888-318-7884. This is Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Open forum, 888-31-TRUTH, our number. If you have a question having anything to do with the Catholic faith, we'd love to take that question today. Jimmy Akin, our senior apologist here, is ready to take those calls. Again, 888-318-7884. I want to say hi to Fabian watching in Uganda. Anybody watching on Facebook in Africa today, give us a shout out there on Facebook, and I'll try to give you a shout out here, trying to get to the various places around the world where people watch. We go now to Nate in Texas watching on YouTube. You are on with Jimmy Akin. Nate?
Sorry about that. I didn't mean to step on the intro. I was wondering about all the Eucharistic miracles that have happened over the years, and we have samples. I think part of the witnesses' testimony is that tests have shown that they are human flesh and blood. So I was wondering, with the advances of technology, what is Jesus' blood type? What is the sequence of his genome? And have they been compared to make sure that they are all the same flesh and blood?
I'm not aware of studies that have been done of that nature. There may have been some blood typing studies. I'm not aware of anyone that's tried sequencing DNA from those, and I'm not aware of anyone who's done comparative tests. So I'm simply not aware of research that's been done in that direction. Even if research had been done in that direction, now obviously if they all came up the same, well, that would be very scientifically striking because, you know, this how you would get exactly the same DNA in different Eucharistic miracles in different parts of the world would be, you know, very remarkable. It's not something that would be easy to have happen through any natural means. So that would be something that the Church would need to look at. Thus far, though, the Church hasn't said anything in particular about – now, it has acknowledged some Eucharistic miracles as being miraculous in nature. But what it hasn't done is take the further step to say, and these contain the exact DNA of Jesus or the exact blood type of Jesus. That's a determination the Church hasn't made and I assume would not make unless such studies had been done. And the Church could look at the results of them. But as far as I know, such studies have not yet been done. And so I have to – since the Church hasn't ruled on this, I have to leave it open regarding do miracles work in this way, that they would produce exactly the same blood type and exactly the same DNA or not. One would assume that they do. But that's still something that, given the nature of the miraculous, which is to be unusual – our ordinary intuitions may not apply, and the Church hasn't rendered a judgment in this area. So I have to leave those questions open personally.
Okay, Nate.
Okay, thank you. I appreciate it. I would think that they would be expected to be the same.
That's
so
what one
I
would
look
expect.
Forward to those findings.
Yeah, that's what one would expect. But as far as I know, studies haven't been done on that point.
Thanks, Nate. Thanks very much for that call. Let's go now to Terry in Michigan, listening on EWTN online. Terry, your question for Jimmy Akin.
Hi, Si. Hi, Jimmy. Jimmy, I appreciate the articles you've written in the past about the pagan roots and observance and history of Easter and Christmas and so forth.
Yeah, I should clarify just for folks that there aren't any pagan roots of Easter. That's what those articles were about.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
that always comes up this time of year. Mm-hmm. Jimmy, I thought I read an article. I was trying to find it today online that you wrote about the supposed use of the Christmas Carol, the 12 Days of Christmas, as a Catholic catechism during mm-hmm. the times of Henry VIII and Elizabeth I in England, and I'm not finding the proof. Have you written on this? Have you done any research on this matter?
I have researched it. I think I've written about it on my blog, so you might want to go to jimmyakin.com and search in the search box for 12 Days of Christmas. So for people who may not be aware, there's this claim that the 12 Days of Christmas is a kind of crypto-catechism that was used by Catholics to pass on aspects of the Catholic faith during times of persecution by Protestants. And so the 12 Lords a-leaping would be the 12 apostles, and the four calling birds would be the four gospels and things like that. The problem is there doesn't seem to be good historical evidence for this. It's also not really intuitive why one would need to have a crypto catechism of this nature. Most of the items on it are things that would have been believed by Protestants. I mean, they certainly believe in the four gospels. They believe the 12 apostles were important. The partridge in a pear tree, if memory serves, that's supposed to be the crucified Christ. Well, they certainly believed in that too. So it's not clear why they would need a crypto catechism like this. Also, it's not clear that the catechism would be all that effective, because these images, I mean, yeah, you can find something in the Christian faith that you can associate with any given number, but the images aren't really that suggestive of what they're supposed to represent. If you're growing up in, you know, Renaissance or post-Renaissance era England, 12 lords leaping is not going to suggest to your mind the 12 apostles, but a comical scene involving actual British lords leaping around. Similarly, a partridge in a pear tree really doesn't suggest the crucified Christ. I mean, it suggests a partridge that happens to be in a pear tree. And so all of these things, they're interesting images, but they're not really that closely tied to what they supposedly represent. Having said all that, you know, even though it's not obvious why one would want a crypto catechism of this nature or why it would be that effective, sure, people could have come up with one. But the question then is, and the ultimate question is, do we have any evidence that this actually was used in this way? And from the reading I've done, the answer seems to be no.
Okay, Terry?
Yeah, so just check it out in your blog, Jimmy.
Yeah.
Thanks, Terry. Thanks very much for that call. We have time to go to Sarah in Cincinnati, Ohio, listening to EWTN on Sirius Satellite Radio. Sarah, your question for Jimmy.
Yes, hi, Jimmy, and Cy. Thank you so much for taking my call.
Hi, Sarah.
I've been wondering a lot lately about what the church's position is with respect to swearing with your hand on the Bible. Mm-hmm. I recall reading in the Gospel of Matthew something to the effect that, you know, you should not swear at all, but let your yes mean yes and your no mean no.
Mm-hmm. The standard understanding of that, and this isn't uniquely Catholic, this is something that's shared by most Christians, is that what Jesus is prohibiting there is kind of casual swearing, and swearing not in the sense of using cuss words. That's not, you know, the kind of swearing we're talking about. And you understand that, Sarah, that the swearing we're talking about is like, I swear to God. And that kind of casual swearing, like if I were to be telling Cy about some amazing thing I learned and I said, swear to God that's true.
Uh-huh.
Okay, that's the kind of swearing that Jesus is prohibiting. It's a kind of casual swearing that is done in a way that sort of cheapens the divine name in the sense of the sacred. And it would be better to, rather than having to invoke such things to get people to believe you, to just be honest and just let your yes be yes and your no be no without having to add these frivolous additions. That's a different thing, though, than for example, being in a courtroom where there can be intense pressures for people to lie. and where there where really massive stakes can be in play, you know, like life or death or massive fines or imprisonment or things like that. And so in those situations, there can be a reason for people to take an oath, or similarly, like, you know, going into battle, like when you join an army or when you take a very high position, like a president or a Supreme Court justice or something like that, that has very serious responsibilities, there can be a reason in those situations to have someone make a solemn promise that what they're going to say and do is the truth or is in conformity with the duties that of their office. And so that's not casual swearing where one just voluntarily does it. That's a special kind of solemn promise that there can be legitimate reasons for. And the standard view among Christians has been that that's not something Jesus is prohibiting here. He's prohibiting the voluntary casual swearing as opposed to the compulsory solemn promising that happens in court settings and things like that.
Thanks, Sarah, very much for that question. We'll go now to Ryan in Fresno, California. Ryan, your question for Jimmy Akin.
Hi, happy Advent.
Happy Advent.
I was wondering, so I have a question for a friend who isn't Catholic,
mm-hmm.
And I couldn't really quite answer this myself.
What's the question?
Which is, so why do we as Catholics address our clergy, specifically priests, as Father, even though, and they cited this Bible passage to me, which was Matthew, where Jesus says, call no man Father.
Yep. So this is a subject we deal with a lot here on Catholic Answers, and we've got some resources online that can give you, and I mention that because we're coming up on a break. But if you go to Catholic.com and type in priests, Father, you'll get some resources right there online that'll go into this in more detail than I have time to at the moment. But to give you a brief answer, Jesus is using hyperbole. Hyperbole is exaggeration to make a point. And it's clear that he's exaggerating because if we were literally to call no man father, we wouldn't even be able to call our biological fathers father. And that would actually undermine the understanding of God as Father. If we couldn't even acknowledge our human fathers as fathers, then that would totally undermine our ability to think about God as a father. And so really what Jesus is saying here is don't confuse any form of human fatherhood with divine fatherhood. God the Father has a kind of fatherhood that's superior to any human fatherhood, even though it's obviously related to human fatherhood. Otherwise, the Bible wouldn't describe God as a father. So in terms of clergy, why would we want to refer to them as fathers? And the answer is because they have a role as spiritual fathers, and that's something we see in the New Testament in multiple different books. St. Paul refers to himself as the Corinthians' father. He refers to Timothy as his son. Peter refers to Mark as his son. John refers to his readers as my little children. And so we regularly see the authors of the New Testament putting themselves in the position of spiritual fathers. So they have a spiritual fatherly role, not the same as God's, but nevertheless a real one. And because it's a real form of spiritual fatherhood, God doesn't have a problem with people acknowledging what's true. So if God's ministers have a form of spiritual fatherhood, it's okay for us to acknowledge that as long as we don't confuse that with the ultimate fatherhood that God has.
Okay, Ryan.
All right, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Ryan. Appreciate it. And before we go to the break, I want to remind you, if you have not yet, it's a great time to sign up for Radio Club. You just go to catholic.com/radioclub. And what happens when you sign up for Radio Club is you get a weekly newsletter-ish type email where we tell you about everything that's going on here in the radio department. There's little articles, there's stuff to listen to, and we'd love to send it to you. But right now, if you go to catholic.com/radioclub and sign up, we're also sending you a free MP3 from our own Jimmy Akin on what the Reformation was really all about. That comes from our most recent conference here in San Diego. Love to send that to you absolutely free. Just go to catholic.com/radio club, and we will be right back after this with more on Catholic Answers Live.
Catholic Answers Live.
The Trump administration rolls back the Health and Human Services contraceptive mandate.
U.S. bishops calling for the total elimination of nuclear weapons.
Pope Francis offers prayers for the victims of the California wildfires.
The U.S. House of Representatives has passed a bill banning abortions after 20 weeks.
And Pope Francis says the death penalty is contrary to the gospel.
Your link to news headlines Catholics count on at the top of the hour. Weekdays on EWTN Radio.
Did the Catholic Church add books to the Bible? Or did Protestants remove 7 books from the Old Testament? Why Catholic Bibles Are Bigger takes you on a fact-filled tour through the history of the Bible, revealing the whole story behind the lost books of the Protestant Old Testament. With the latest information and discourse on crucial issues, Why Catholic Bibles Are Bigger is a book that belongs in the library of every serious student of Scripture. And as a special bonus, if you order online, we'll add an ebook copy of 15 Myths, Mistakes, and Misrepresentations about the Deuterocanon to your order absolutely free. Get your free ebook today. Order your copy of Why Catholic Bibles Are Bigger by logging on to our online shop at shop.catholic.com.
Just like the saint of the Counter-Reformation, our own souls are in constant need of reform, of reconversion to God and His will for us. We struggle with sin. We become distracted in prayer. We find it hard to be loving and easy to be selfish. In Reform Yourself, Sean McAfee shows you how these magnificent saints can be guides to your own personal transformation. We all need to reform our souls. Let the saints who reformed the church show you how. Order your copy of Reform Yourself today by calling 1-888-291-8000, visiting the shop at Catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Cy Kellett, your host, Jimmy Akin, our guest, and wanted to say, as we're approaching Christmas, trying to say hi to people from around the world. We got to say hi to some folks in the Philippines the other day, trying to say hi to folks watching on Facebook in Africa today. And it looks like some folks are saying hi to us, but maybe not sharing where they are in Africa. So we got Ferdy from Nigeria. Hi, Ferdy. But if you are somewhere in Africa, just let us know the country. Just say hi from and whatever country you're in, and we'd be happy to say hi to you. And maybe tomorrow we'll do – I was thinking either Brazil or Australia tomorrow. What do you think, Nick? Do Brazil tomorrow? Okay. And we'll keep trying to say hi to folks around the world as we approach Christmas, trying to I like it because it's fun to get to visit with people all around the world. Let's go to Catherine in St. George, Kansas, listening on The Sword. You are on with Jimmy Akin.
Hi, Jimmy. Hi, Cy.
Hi.
Happy Advent. I have been praying the rosary for the joyful mysteries, of course, and really kind of, you know, focusing and reflecting on those mysteries. And the last one, the finding in the temple, I just wanted you to maybe explain kind of how that went down in terms of, you know, they were worried and they went to the temple. But that would appear to be something that was different other than, I don't know, a sinless, I mean, of course, our Savior is sinless and blameless, as well as Mary and Joseph were saints. So was it that they had knowledge that he would be there, and that way they wouldn't worry? And
no,
you know,
they didn't have knowledge, and they did worry. In fact, Luke tells us that when they got back to Jerusalem, that they searched for him for like 3 days before they found him. And then when they did find him, Mary talks to Jesus and says, "Why have you done this to us? Don't you know that you and I and your father have been worried about you?" And so they didn't know where he was going to be, and they did worry about him. I can tell you a certain amount about this story, and beyond that, I can speculate a little bit about it. But in terms of what we actually know, it's all found right there in Luke chapter 2. So I'd suggest, you know, rereading that just to, you know, refresh your memory on a few points, and it could make a good thing to kind of meditate about and you know, think about the different points that are mentioned there. But basically, and for people who may not be familiar with the story, when Jesus was 12 years old, his family went on a pilgrimage to Jerusalem. They were living in Nazareth at the time, and they went to Jerusalem for one of the annual feasts. There were several feasts every year where Jewish people were ordinarily required to go make a visit to Jerusalem, and so they did. And they were traveling with other people from Nazareth, and then when their party got ready to go back to Nazareth, Mary and Joseph started out with the rest of the party, and Luke tells us they thought that Jesus was with them, and they were mistaken about that. So when they realized they'd gone like a day's journey away, and when they realized, hey, he's not in the party, they realized, okay, he must have been left back in Jerusalem. So they go back to Jerusalem. They search for him for 3 days, finally find him in the temple. And when Mary asks him, well, you know, why have you done this and so forth, Jesus says, didn't you know I'd be in my Father's house, meaning the temple, meaning God is his Father. And just to communicate the fact that this was not an act of rebelliousness on Jesus's part, Luke says that he went back to Nazareth with them and was obedient to them. So Luke is making the point and answering kind of the concern that's motivating the question. You know, I mean, is this disobedience? Is he being sinful here? No, he was an obedient child. He had reasons for what he did. We're not told explicitly about this. We're not told explicitly why he was left in Jerusalem. It could be that he's not at fault at all. It is the case that he's not at fault at all, but it could be that the reason he didn't leave with the rest of everybody is he wasn't told when everybody else was going. I mean, they were organizing things, and it could be one of the situations where everyone assumes that everybody's been told when, in fact, not everybody has been told, and somebody gets left behind purely by accident. Kind of like, you know, the movie Home Alone. If I recall correctly, Kevin McAllister.
Oh, that's right. They forgot that they had left him at home.
Exactly. Yeah. Same thing. And it's not that he deliberately stayed behind. It's just through an accident of communication or whatever, they leave thinking he's with them. And it could be the same thing here. Mary and Joseph presumably assumed that other people had rounded up Jesus like with the other children. There might have been one person in their party who was delegated to go get all the kids, and that person happened to miss Jesus. And then when Jesus found himself home alone in Jerusalem, he said, well, the logical place for me to go is my Father's house, and so I'll go to the temple. And they can figure out, okay, that's where he's going to be, you mm-hmm. know, given that we don't have relatives here other than God. He's going to go to Jesus, to his Father's house. And so they eventually figure that out, but not as quickly as they might have.
Catherine, what do you think of that?
Well, I think that the miscommunication is a very good explanation. And I just wanted to clarify that in no ways, if I had implied that he was being disobedient or there was sin, because I do mm-hmm. know and feel that, of course, it was in perfect harmony
right.
with our Lord, and how it can be a model for us who are in a crisis situation. I just did that further explanation of miscommunication was probably the missing piece. So thank you very much.
No problem. And it's understood you were not asked saying, did Jesus sin? It was how do we square these things? That was perfectly clear.
I have six brothers and sisters, and we would frequently be on the road and realize
uh-huh.
somebody wasn't in the car.
Got left in the
car. I wouldn't say frequently, but
or,
occasionally, yeah. Mm-hmm. I think I still have a brother in Kansas. I'm not sure.
He got left there?
Okay. Yeah, but about 40 years ago. That's not really true. Danny, in Arlington, Texas, you are listening on Guadalupe Radio. You are on with Jimmy Akin. Your question, please.
Hey, Jimmy. Hey, Si. Thank you guys for taking my call. I'm actually on my way into the church with my wife and I, and our family will be starting RCIA here in a month or so, hopefully.
Congratulations.
I was just wondering if you could give a better explanation on how Latin became the official language of the church.
Okay. Well, I guess the first thing I'd have to question is the extent to which Latin is the quote-unquote official language of the church. I'm not aware of a document that says exactly that. It is the language that is commonly used in certain classes of official documents, but yeah. there are also official documents that are written in other languages too. And so, you know, I would say it's a language that gets used in official documents and very commonly so, but there are official documents that are drafted and published in other languages as well. In terms of the reason why Latin became very influential, it's because of the way Christianity spread. It started in Palestine, which in among Jewish Palestinians, and at the time Jewish Palestinians spoke Aramaic and Hebrew and a little bit of Greek. And Greek was the international language. So as Christianity began to spread, a lot of people were Christian who spoke Greek. But eventually, St. Peter in particular migrated to Rome and became Bishop of Rome and left his successors in Rome. So that's where it was the capital of the empire. So it was a natural place for him to go to spread Christianity throughout the empire, was obviously from its capital. And that meant that the language of the capital was going to become prominent in Christianity, because it was something that flowed throughout the empire. Now, at the time, a lot of people in Rome were bilingual. They spoke both Latin and Greek. The Roman emperors, for example, tended to speak Latin. I mean, they grew up speaking Latin, but they tended to also have a good knowledge of Greek, even though it wasn't their native language. Well, over time, as the empire progressed, Latin became more and more dominant in the West, and Greek kind of receded, so not as many people knew it. And that's the reason that the prominence of Latin in the West is the reason why you have the different Romance languages that are descended from Latin, like Spanish and Portuguese and Italian and French and Romanian. All of those languages are really descendants of the Latin language. And so because Latin was the language of the empire and thus it was very influential in Western Europe, and because Christianity then spread throughout the empire, the most common language in the West was adopted by the church for most purposes, and thus Latin was adopted. And then eventually, as these other languages developed, and not just the Romance ones, but others like English and so forth, it was useful to retain Latin in the church in the West for official communications, because it was something that everybody in every area had some knowledge of. If you were literate and well-educated, even if you were in a place like Germany or England that spoke a Germanic language, you would still have knowledge of Latin. And that's been true down until very recently. Educated people would have knowledge of Latin. And so rather than invest the resources in writing a document in Latin and then translating it into a bunch of languages, it was simply easier to write it in Latin and send it out, and the educated people would be able to read it. And so that's one of the things that happened in the West. More recently, as knowledge of Latin has faded, the church has seen value in producing those translations. And so today, even when a document is prepared in Latin, it's very quickly typically translated into other languages like English and German and Spanish and so forth, and then posted on the Vatican website. Does that help?
That's an awesome answer. Thank you. And
no
thank
problem.
You guys for doing such a great job.
Thank you,
Danny. Blessed Advent to you and yours. Again, we're saying hi to folks from Africa today. This is as we get closer to Christmas, trying to go around the world. But I have to say, Jimmy, on the Facebook page, people mm-hmm. from all over the world saying hi now, which is
awesome.
Really nice. And so we'll say hi to Steve from Malawi. But I wanted to also say hi to Mary, because I don't think we're going to do the Federated States of Micronesia. And she's
well, we can have an Oceania Day.
Well, we could do all of Oceania, I suppose. Yeah that's true. But so hi.
Pacific Rim Day.
Hi to Mary.
It's a fun movie, by the way, Pacific Rim.
I have not seen it. Yeah, that's a kind of a monster movie.
Yeah, it's a kaiju film.
Yeah. Well, Mary's on the island of Yap in the Federated States of Micronesia. Mm-hmm. Happy Advent to you too, Mary. We'll take a quick break. We'll be right back with more Open Forum on Catholic Answers Live with Jimmy Akin after this.
Catholic Answers Live with Jimmy Akin is coming right back.
I met my husband in my first year of college. We both came from strong Catholic families and wanted lots of children. After 3 years of marriage and still not pregnant, we felt our dream of a big family slipping away. My sister encouraged us to visit our local Catholic store and get a novena to St. Gerard. When we arrived, we were unsure about our need, but the staff was kind and helpful. Wow, what an incredible Catholic store. They encouraged us to pray and trust in God's providence. One worker told us stories of other couples, just like us, who were desperate to start a family. 4 years and two children later, we have been back to that incredible Catholic store for baby, baptism, and toddler gifts. God bless the staff at that incredible Catholic store. An incredible Catholic store in your area can be found at incrediblecatholicstore.com. The Incredible Catholic Store, transforming the world one soul at a time.
As the legend goes, the Protestant Reformation began when Martin Luther nailed the list of his grievances with the Catholic Church to the door of All Saints Church in Wittenberg, Germany. But do you know the whole story? In Catholic Answers' brand new documentary, The Protestant Revolution, you will hear from top apologists Tim Staples, Jimmy Akin, Carla Broussard, Trent Horn, and Steve Weidenkopf as they expose the errors of Martin Luther and of the other so-called reformers. This DVD will give you a clearer understanding of our Protestant brothers and sisters, and you will be better equipped to engage them about what separates us and about what unites us. Order your copy of The Protestant Revolution today by calling 1-888-291-8000, visiting shop.catholic.com, or by asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Catholic Answers Live is brought to you in part by CatholicSingles.com, the website for Catholics who want to meet others who share their faith and values for faith, fellowship, and love. You can learn more at CatholicSingles.com. Catholic Answers Live thanks CatholicSingles.com for their generous support.
Call now with your question, 888-318-7884. This is Catholic Answers Live.
I'm going to have a trouble with this one, Jimmy. Indibiarie?
Okay.
From the
Côte d'Ivory?
Oh yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm.
Ivory right. Coast.
Ivory Coast. Yeah.
You know, right. Saying hello to people from all these places now has me I've got an earworm of the Animaniacs Nations of the World song playing in my head.
Oh, I'm going to have to YouTube that one later.
Yeah.
Really?
United States, Canada, Mexico, Panama, Haiti, Jamaica, Peru, Republic, Dominican, Cuba, Caribbean, Greenland, El Salvador, two, Costa Rica, Bermuda, Bahamas, Tobago. No, I missed one, but Bahamas, Tobago, San Juan, Paraguay, Uruguay, Suriname, and French Guiana, Barbados, and Guam. There's Syria, Lebanon, Israel, Jordan,
Bahamas, Kuwait, and Bahrain.
No, I won't. Not today. Maybe when you finished your tour of saying hello to people around the world, I'll sing the whole song.
Okay, all right. How many countries are there in the world, Jimmy? Do you know?
Well, it's a little more than 300.
Yeah. Are they all like UN members, or is – Is that
no? There are some that actually aren't,
okay.
but there are the ones that are kind of debated, like they don't have universal recognition, like Sealand.
Oh yeah, so forth, Sealand. You know. It's one guy, isn't it?
No, it's not one guy, but it is one oil platform.
One oil platform. All right, Dan in Ohio, listening on 89.6 FM. You are on with Jimmy Akin. Your question, please.
Hey, I listen to your show every night I can. You're coming across here. I drive for a living, and I listen. Your question and answer talk show. I really enjoy it.
Thank you, Dan. Thanks very much.
What's your question?
The question I have is sexual immorality in the Bible.
Mm-hmm.
I can't quite understand why Abraham had sex with a maidservant and had child by her. When that, it just really puzzled me. The leader of our religious nation and how can they justify that? What's the answer the Catholics have on that?
Okay. Well, so there are a couple things to take into account here. First one is the Bible records things and people doing things that are bad. Even people who are good and important have done things that are bad. And the Bible is extremely honest about that. I mean, David – for example, is described as a man after God's own heart. But even David sinned in big ways. I mean, he seduced the wife of Uriah the Hittite, Bathsheba, and got her pregnant. And – or it might be more accurate to say she seduced him. But in any event, they had an affair and he got her pregnant. And then when he couldn't trick her husband into thinking that the baby was his, he arranged for the husband to die in battle. And so he encompassed the death of a man in order to cover up his own adultery with the man's wife. So that's something that the Bible's very honest about. David had great strengths, but he also had great flaws. And so when we read the Bible talking about somebody doing something bad, that doesn't mean the Bible's approving of it. Furthermore, when you look at the case of Abraham, it makes it clear that Abraham's really not doing what he's supposed to when he has the child by the maidservant Hagar. Now, this was a very common thing in ancient society. It was not, and partly we were dealing with a polygamous society at the time. So men could have multiple wives. They could have concubines in addition to wives. And that was just part of the morality of the day. And so in assessing Abraham's guilt, we would have to say, well, what was he trained with? What was culturally expected? What would have formed his conscience? You know, today we would look at that and say, well, you should not do that. But it was an accepted practice in his day. And he had been promised by God that he would have a son. But when he couldn't have a son with his wife Sarah, she then proposes this improvised solution of let me use my maidservant Hagar to fulfill this promise of us having a son. And since Hagar is a member of the household and she's responsible and reports to Sarah, it's kind of viewed as if she's sort of an extension of Sarah. At least that's how they looked at it at the time. Well, God didn't look at it that way because once the child Ishmael is born, God tells Abraham, nope, this is not the promised son. You're going to have a son by Sarah. So the Bible makes it clear that in having a son by Hagar, Abraham was kind of running ahead of God's plan and not really doing what he needed to fulfill God's promise, that which was be patient and you'll eventually have a son with Sarah. So that's the essence of what I would say. The Bible doesn't approve of everything that it depicts people doing. It's very honest about human sin. And in this case, it indicates that Abraham wasn't doing what God wanted him to do. He was not waiting and being patient on God to fulfill his promise. So those are the key points.
Okay, Dan.
Could it be the custom of the time? Could that have been part of this?
Well, I mentioned that in terms of if we want to assess Abraham's level of culpability for this, we need to take into account the nature of the society in which he grew up, which was one where this was much more common and much more expected. So, you know, that helps us understand his personal level of accountability. And we can say, okay, well, he wouldn't be accountable in the same way a person today would because today we wouldn't be raised to think this is an acceptable practice. But even then, the Bible makes it clear this wasn't God's plan.
Thanks, Dan. We're going to move on because we'll get as many calls as we can in here before the top of the hour. We go now to Tran in Wiley, Texas, listening on Guadalupe Radio. Tran, your question for Jimmy Akin.
Hello, Ms. Lucullus. Hello, Mr. Akins. How are you doing?
Very well, Tran. How are you?
Good, good. Happy Advent. I get a question. I was taught that only ordained priests or religious brother can read the gospel and deliver the homily. So every time I go to Sunday Mass and the gospel and the homily was delivered by the non-religious deacon, I just have an easiness. And how do I get that out of my mind and so I can concentrate on the Mass? Because I doubt the validity of the Mass. I just talk to myself.
Okay.
Let me
say a couple of things about that. The first thing is Masses are not valid or invalid. They're not. That's not a category that applies to the Mass as a whole. What can be valid or invalid is the consecration. But who reads the gospel has nothing to do with the consecration. It has no bearing on whether the consecration is valid or invalid. For a valid consecration, you need the appropriate minister, and for that it is a priest. You need the proper words. This is my body. This is the cup of my blood, and so forth. You need the proper matter, bread and wine, and you need the proper intention, which is to do the consecration. So none of that has anything to do with who reads the gospel. So even if a completely inappropriate person read the gospel, it would not affect the validity of the consecration. What does apply to masses as a whole is not validity, but liceity. Liceity has to do with whether or not something is done in accordance with the law. So if the people celebrating Mass do it in accordance with the law, then the Mass is licit or lawful. If they break laws in celebrating Mass, then that renders the Mass unlawful or illicit, but it still can leave the consecration perfectly valid just in the context of an illicit Mass. So what about the reading of the gospel? Well, actually, what the church's law says is that not that it has to be read by a priest, but that it has to be read by an ordained person, a bishop, priest, or deacon. And so since deacons are ordained, they're perfectly fine for reading the gospel. Same thing goes for delivering the homily, which is also reserved to ordained persons. So deacons can read the gospel. They can deliver the homily. Those are both diaconal functions. In fact, if a deacon is present at a Mass, it's even preferred that in the law that he be the one to at least read the gospel. That same preference isn't there for delivering the homily. There's more of a preference for the priest delivering the homily and allowing deacons to do it occasionally. But there is actually a preference that the deacon be the one to read the gospel if there's a deacon at the Mass. So that's the state of the law, and if that's what you're seeing happening in parishes in your area, nothing unlawful is happening, and it's totally fine.
Thank you very much, Tran. Let's go to Gloria in Culver City, California, listening on Relevant Radio. Gloria, your question for Jimmy Akin.
Yes, my question is, what is the Catholic Church's position on organ donations?
Okay. It's an interesting question. The basic position is that organ donation is fine and can even be praiseworthy, but there are certain things we need to watch out for. One of the things that we need to watch out for is donation of vital organs before a person is dead. You can't kill a person in order to get their organs, even to save somebody else's life. So, for example, you couldn't – let's say I'm injured in a car crash and maybe I'm going to die. Well, you can't say, oh, he's still alive, but you know what? He's not going to be using that heart for too much longer, so let's just take it right now. Mm-hmm. Well, that would directly kill me, and you can't kill a person to get his organs. So donating organs is fine, but killing a person to get their organs is not fine.
Okay?
Yeah, okay.
Thanks, Gloria. So sum up the show. Do not kill Jimmy Akin. Does that sum up?
Oh, yeah, please.
Yeah, okay, that's
thank you.
Very,
I appreciate that.
Yeah,
all right. I want to make sure we're all clear on that.
Okay,
point.
Very good. Are you wearing the green coming for towards Christmas, or is it just a happenstance that you wore green?
It's just my accent color for today.
Oh, okay. Jimmy Akin, senior apologist here at Catholic Answers. You can get his book, A Daily Defense, 365 Days Plus One to Becoming a Better Apologist at shop.catholic.com. Everything there is 30% off right now. You can get all of his – I think you can get all your books there, right, at shop.catholic.com?
Pretty much.
Yeah.
Except for the secret ones on Amazon.com.
Oh, secret. Oh, secret books. I got to find out about this at the break. Hey, if you're in Africa, say hi to us on Facebook and give us the country so we can say hi to you. We'll be right back with Father Paul Keller and more Open Forum on Catholic Answers Live right after this.